Hades is a game where you learn as you play, and we strongly recommend experiencing your early runs on your own to enjoy everything without spoilers for the first time. This podcast will assume you have reached the final boss, unlocked all the weapons, and met all the characters. Any additional spoilers will be disclosed in the episode. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome to Hidden Aspects, a podcast about Hades. I'm your host, Ridiculous Hat, and this week we are joined by game designer Connor Koo. Connor, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Doing okay. Glad to be here. Thanks so much for coming on the show. And listeners, we'll be getting to know Connor in a bit, but you can also get to know everyone by following our social media accounts, in addition to following us on whatever podcast platform you like. Check us out at Hidden Aspects on Twitter, and join our Discord. Link is in the show notes and on the Twitter page. So, Connor, let's get to know you a bit more. Tell us a bit about yourself and your background with how you got into gaming. And you're in the industry, but I mean like as a player, and then we'll dive into the industry stuff. Don't worry about that.
Sure. Yeah, so I started playing video games when I was really little, maybe when I was about 4 or 5. I think one of my first games was actually playing StarCraft 1. It was sort of introduced to me by one of my dad's friends. And I got pretty hooked on that. And then my parents spoiled me with some video game consoles. I remember playing a lot of Mario Kart with my dad. I sort of just continued on playing games. As I got older, I got really into World of Warcraft. And I played a ton of Warcraft 3. So, it just only made sense that I wanted to play, like third person Warcraft stuff at the time. And I still play WoW today. So, I've played all sorts of games. I would say I've played a ton of competitive games, but I'm also really into more story-based games, and I do love to dabble in a lot of indie games.
You were sort of an indie dev with the way your path went, which we'll talk about in a second. But yeah, it's indie games are kind of the creativity is unbound, and you find some real gems in there sometimes. There's a lot of them out there. If you buy the itch.io, that bundle for racial equality, that had, 1,000 games in it? So many.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, there's a ton of people out there making stuff, but every so often you run into, a Hollow Knight or a Papers, Please or something like that that's really just transformative. World of Warcraft. Shadowlands is really great. It's a really great expansion.
Yeah, I've been having a lot of fun with Shadowlands. I've played WoW since Classic I was in middle school. And so, it's always, I love, a new expansion launch. It's always so exciting. I got to work on one of the expansions myself. I got to work on Battle for Azeroth while I was on Team 2 QA. So I've gotten to sort of have the whole WoW experience at this point.
You've done everything except I don't think you've made content for it yet.
Right.
We'll see where.
Yeah, no, I've helped contribute to some content, but never actually just been in the editor making stuff for a while.
Yeah. But, you're young. There's time. What are your favorite non-Hades games? You've definitely talked about WoW and the Warcraft universe. Beyond that, what stands out to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Since it's sort of time relevant, one of my favorite games of all time is actually Animal Crossing. The original one was, I spent so much time on it, and I don't even think I really had a full understanding of how to appreciate it when I first played it. I was a little kid playing it on GameCube, but I remember, I played it for over a year. I remember going through all the events and stuff. I remember hooking up my Game Boy Advance to link it to get to the island, and there was all, it's just a really interesting game. The way it was presented, especially back then for its time, it's really interesting. There weren't many games that had, maybe no games that had successfully had a daily check-in system, and we didn't even really think of them that way back then. So it's interesting to see how that game has developed over the years. I did play the most recent one, and I had a lot of fun with it for a while. It's such a nostalgic adventure for me to play Animal Crossing. I have played tons of League of Legends. I'm not an active player anymore, but I did play a lot. I played on my university's team at UC Santa Cruz. So I used to be a really, you know, competitive, diehard League of Legends player back in the day. I was also a big Magic the Gathering player. I played tons of Magic the Gathering, both casually and competitively. I used to be a tournament grinder. I'd be traveling all over the place, like going to tournaments, and that was a lot of fun. Yeah, so those are some of my favorite games. I'm also randomly like really into fighting games. Haven't been really like actively playing one recently, but you know, I love Street Fighter and I love Smash. So
the FGC is kind of a universe unto itself and has some of the best YouTube content out there. There's a lot of great fighting game community YouTube content creators and like a lot of interesting storylines. I watched a documentary recently about how the game Catherine became kind of a fighting game competitive thing. It was the weird like Japanese in your head RPG. League of Legends, Magic the Gathering. So those are some old school names. I'm glad you grew out of League. You know, it's a popular game. It comes up a lot in the show, but I can't think of too many people that look back at their time in League all that fondly, just because of the nature of how hyper-competitive that space can be.
Yeah, I mean, League is, I like thinking about, like, the history of League. It's pretty interesting.
It's a huge thing, right? It's a huge game, and it has an identity all its own.
Right. Yeah, I started playing it, like, when it was in, I guess, probably in beta. I started in high school, and I sort of played it pretty avidly, like, through most of college. But, yeah, I mean, it is a pretty interesting game. Like, it has that really competitive aspect, you know. I mean, but it's also a game that's, like, it can be really fun to play, like, socially. And so, you know, I've always had different groups of people that I would play it with. You know, sometimes it's more competitive, sometimes it was more casual. But it's interesting because, you know, it's, for the most part, it's the same game that it's been forever. And, you know, they change certain little systems here. They introduce new heroes, but like the recipe is just, you know, of like the sort of like Dota type MOBA is, it just seems like it's very proven at this point to be, you know, pretty addicting and fun.
And the skill ceiling is crazy. There are players that spend thousands of hours on single characters. Like it's that if you were to change that dynamic too much from patch to patch, it would be impossible for players to really master it without exorbitant time commitments, which they're already making.
Right. Yeah, Lee does an incredible job of creating like individual player stories, because there's so much potential for you to just have an exciting game moment, you know, that moment you can look back on. And yes, it's the same sort of game, you know, each time you queue up, but every game is unique and every game is sort of its own story. And, you know, it sort of has extremely high highs and some pretty extreme lows as well. But, you know, that high just keeps people like wanting to play because it's so exciting every time you get it.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the structure of, you look at American football, it's been 100 years of taking the ball in your hand and throwing it down the field, but it's just, we don't call that stale. It's got a rhythm to it. There's a lot of skill. There's a lot of moving parts. So the structure doesn't have to change all that much. And League has been one of the few games that I think has built that really consistent structure. And so maybe the pieces change inside, but the rules aren't being rewritten every year.
Right, right.
Yeah. So how did you parlay this passion as a player into getting into the industry?
Well, when I was, you know, about to go to college, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to study. I was really into computers. I spent a lot of time on the computer. So I sort of like was looking around and I was applying to UC Santa Cruz and they had a degree. It was computer science game design. I thought maybe it'd be cool. So I got into the university and I decided to just go with the major and sort of see how it would play out. For the most part, it's a computer science degree, but you get a lot of opportunities to just, you know, make games and spread your wings. And so I didn't fall in love so much with the computer science part of it, but I did with the game design part of it. And, you know, I was already someone who spent a lot of time thinking about games and really, like, strategically speaking, I mean, way back then, I actually wanted to, I was really interested in doing, like, balance design for video games. Much less so my passion nowadays, but that was, like, it was something I was really excited about back then, so.
Well, as a gamer, you think about, like, I could tweak these numbers better. That's kind of the mindset, yeah. Right?
Yeah, I think that's, like, almost every competitive gamer is, like, it's almost like part of why you enjoy the game is that you're sort of thinking about like that constantly. And it of course is going to, you know, present you with questions all the time about like, you know, what would it be? Would it be better if it, you know, this number was changed or if this thing was stronger? So yeah, I think that's one of the things that sort of drove me into really enjoying thinking about games.
How all the pieces fit together. So you had mentioned QA for Team 2 for the World of Warcraft team over at Blizzard. Was that your first position with the company or first position in the industry?
Yeah, that was my first position in the industry, actually. I beforehand, you know, I had graduated college and I sort of spent about 2 years before sort of applying for an industry job. I was just, I was coaching volleyball. Funnily enough, I grew up with volleyball. Both my parents were volleyball players and volleyball coaches. My dad was like a really good volleyball player. That's sort of just like what my family does. And so as soon as I graduated, like, you know, I used to coach club volleyball in high school. And, you know, the club director called me and was like, hey, do you want to come back and start coaching again? So I started coaching for, you know, 2 years at a high school and at clubs. But yeah, then I started applying. I was like, you know, it's time to get back into what I wanted to do. And so, you know, I had some friends who were on the, user experience, QA team on Team 2. So there, it's sort of like the team that does a lot of, rating and mythic tuning. There's a lot of very, very seasoned, experienced World of Warcraft players on that, team. And so I decided to apply for it, and you know, I got the job, and I went down and moved out to Irvine.
And here we are. Okay, before we go any further, opinions on Haikyuu?
It's pretty great. I mean, I've watched quite a bit of it. I haven't watched the entire thing, but I do. I mean, it's very obvious to me that they had you know, a couple very volleyball knowledgeable people involved in it. So like, you know, as you're watching it, they have all these like little lessons and stuff, and they tell you, like, they sort of like pause the action and tell you what's going on and why. And a lot of the times it's like super volleyball accurate, and they present, like, they represent it, you know, like visually in a much less realistic way, but like their explanations are very I guess technically sound, I would say, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's, I didn't know you had the volleyball background. I guess it kind of, interesting wrinkle to the Connor Koo story.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's made they made an anime just for you.
Yeah, that was definitely something that my volleyball players, because I coached, you know, mostly like middle school and high school girls for volleyball. And you know, that was something I always brought up, was like, have you watched this?
It's nice that it's authentic, you know, that they have the cutaways, like, this is a real thing that happens. So you transitioned from, this is the fun part of the story, transitioned from QA to a game called Hearthstone.
Yes.
You had a very eventful first few months, I think. how did that go down? You've given this, I know you've given this part of the story many, many times.
Yeah, I can give another overview of that. So, yeah, I was actually a contractor on Team 2 QA for 6 months when I started. And so about 4 months into my contract, you know, a position popped up on Team 5 to do design on Pat Nagel's team, which was the live content team. And so I obviously was trying to use a QA job to get into design. You know, it was sort of my reach goal to get a design position at all at Blizzard, but especially on Team 5, it was actually the team I wanted to end up on. As I mentioned before, I'm super into Magic, and I played tons of Hearthstone as well, you know, when it came out, so I was really passionate about card games. I decided to throw my name in the hat, you know, against, I guess, maybe what most people would say would be, like, super logical, because it's pretty hard to move from, you know, a QA team to design in general, let alone, like, a completely different project. Because you just haven't really, like, built up the same relationships, you know, with the developers. So, yeah, I threw a name in the hat. I went through the interview process and I managed to get the job, much to my QA lead's dismay, you know, because they were sad to be losing me so quickly. But yeah, so I just ended up on team five. I guess that was like January 2019 is when I started. And so, you know, I just sort of jumped in right away. You know, at the time, the team was just really, it was Pat, Joe Mag, and Valerie. And they hadn't really had like a new designer come on that team in a really long time, because, you know, Joe Mag's been, he was at Blizzard for a really, really long time, actually. And Pat has been at Blizzard for longer, almost as long as I've been alive. So, they hadn't really onboarded someone in a long time, so they weren't really 100% sure what to do. So they threw, you know, a tavern brawl at me. They asked me to sort of make the 207th brawl spectacular, which is like the second version of the 100th brawl. And so I implemented it for Joe Mag very quickly, like a lot faster than I think he expected. And so, you know, my like second or third week, they were just like, all right, well, I guess we should just have you make a tavern brawl. And crazy me went to Pat and said, I'm thinking about making this this auto chess thing, you know, in Hearthstone as the tavern brawl. And he was like, if you know Pat at all, he's like, he's very crazy when it comes to like big ideas, you know. Yes. He always starts big.
Big enthusiastic, and big dreamer, you know.
Exactly, exactly. And so he was like, oh, that, he basically was just like, you're crazy, but, you know, give it a shot and see what happens. Yeah, and one thing led to another and sort of led to Battlegrounds. You know, we sort of started up a strike team. You know, I made this sort of 1v1 prototype of it way back in time now, it feels. And it's sort of, you know, the combat system actually in the original prototype is very similar to what we have now in Battlegrounds. It's almost identical. We started testing it. It was fun. And, you know, next thing you know, we were putting together a team to really solidify like what it was and really trying to find what the fun was that in what, you know, was already created and sort of grow it into something bigger.
And I think we can say pretty definitively we found some fun. Because, like, holy crap, man, it's Battlegrounds. Like, this is, you took a second game, you put it inside the first game, and there was this fledgling auto-battler genre where it started with a mod that became Dota Auto Chess, right? And then the standalone, was it Drodo, I think?
That's a company that made the standalone, yeah.
Yep. And then Dota Underlords and TFT came out, and then you're like, you know what, I'm going to put this in Hearthstone. And all of a sudden, I remember that BlizzCon. I got back in line. I think I played it 9 times. Just left the line and went back in. And all the other designers were in the line, too, because they all loved the game so much. And now, mm-hmm. I mean, the success of it is pretty obvious. And you've given plenty of interviews about, you know, how this happened. Do you ever just, like, lay in bed and stare at the ceiling and be like, how did I get here?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do. I mean, I remember even just when like the recruiter told me that I was getting the job to begin with, I was kind of shocked. Like I mentioned before, it was really my like stretch goal to get a design job on Team 5. That was like my stretch goal.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't believe that I was even, you know, making it onto the team to begin with. And, you know, once I was on the team, it felt surreal to just be in the office, you know, like sitting next to Pat and like trying to make stuff. And, you know, of course, it's always a game designer's dream to, you know, want to make a really awesome experience for a bunch of people. And, you know, when we were making it, of course, that's what our goal was. But, you know, we never know like exactly, you know, how everything is going to play out. And, you know, looking back, it's crazy to think that, you know, I was on the main stage at BlizzCon and talking about this thing. You know, the year before I was working the WoW demo, just like standing at the front of the line and like...
You were a blue shirt.
Yeah, I mean, it was a ton of fun and I would love to actually do it again, but it's weird, like fast forward 12 months and I'm like, you know, on the main stage with Mike talking about this thing and in front of a ton of people. I'd never even done something like that before. So yeah, I definitely look back at it, and it is sort of crazy to think, like, you know, how has so much happened in such a short period of time?
Like, you created a mode that led to Hearthstone transforming from game to platform. So, incredible, amazing. Congratulations, of course.
Thank you.
Like, holy crap. Like, I don't know. It's just a crazy thing. And we've actually had a bunch of Hades players on the show talk about their love of BGs. A lot of gaming these days, and we're going to talk about this more later. We had talked before the show about the feeling of there being like this roguelike explosion. And I don't know if it's crossed over into the mainstream outside of Hades as much. Like, mm-hmm. You know, everyone on the show talks about Slay the Spire, but we're interviewing, you know, in-depth content creators that play games, like, for not for a living, but at least right. For some part of their income. You're not going to find your average person out there that's played a lot of roguelikes, but BGs and roguelikes in particular have this, I really want to see what's going to happen next. I want to see what's in the box feeling. Every time you reroll a shop in BGs, or every time you level and hit a triple, or in Hades when, you know, when you hit a god boon and you're saying, do I get the duo? It's that same kind of vibe of, what am I going to get? So why do you think that BGs crosses over with that kind of genre? Is it the same kind of draw?
I think it's definitely got a very similar draw. You know, like, I mean, if you think of like what a roguelike is, it's really like this sort of, you click go and you know you're on an adventure. You're going through this sort of story, and it's going to feel a little different every single time you do it. And that in itself is really similar to, you know, how Battlegrounds functions, right? It's like, you don't know exactly what you're going to do every single game you go into Battlegrounds. You know, you might have an idea of what you might want to do, or a couple things you might want to do, but usually the path to getting there is different, you know, almost every game. So I think that's one of the reasons that it sort of keeps you coming back for more. And of course, there's tons of moments where you're asking that question, what's in the box, right? Where, you know, you every time you start your next turn, you know, you're hoping to just sort of roll into good minions. Every time you go into combat, you know, you're wondering what your opponent's minions are and how your minions are going to play out. You get a triple and you're like, am I going to get that, you know, Bran I need, or that Nomi, or whatever. So there's all these little moments that sort of, I guess, really highlight those exciting, like, ups and downs, I guess, of the game. And I think that's very similar to, you know, roguelikes in general, is there are runs, right, of especially more traditional roguelikes where, you know, they go very poorly and you don't have an exciting story to come out of it. And but, you know, what keeps you playing it and doing another run is like, well, maybe next time I'll get like a really exciting moment.
We call that Spelunky.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, one of the things that is really obviously similar between like Hades and Battlegrounds is that there's a bit more of like a measured excitement because you know exactly when something could happen. Whereas, like, you know, if you're clicking nodes in Slay the Spire, right, on the map, like, you don't always know, like, what might be there. You might get nothing. It might be an enemy, like... whereas, you know, after every single room, I'm getting something pretty much in Hades, right? And after every turn in Battlegrounds, you know you have a chance to really, like, get something. And you're always going to get something, you know? So you're always curious, like, I know this is happening. And so if I just make it to the next recruit phase, and that's sort of the loop you go through. It's like, if I just make it to the next recruit phase, I'm going to be really strong.
Yeah. And also another similarity, really... Bob is just Hypnos. Very similar.
Yes.
They both mean well, but both are just the dagger right to the heart.
Yeah.
So Hades, I remember when 1.0 came out, there was this cultural explosion of every sphere in the universe was talking about Hades, including a lot of folks at the Blizzard office. I mean, it, you know, everyone that was playing games at the time was like, wow, this is amazing. So how did you find about it, and what drew you into it?
I started playing it, I want to say it was about a year after it went on PC, so basically as soon as it went on Steam is when I decided to buy it. It's been something on my radar for, like, quite a long time, actually. I've played the other Supergiant games, and I'm a decently big fan of them. I'm always a big fan of the art style and the aesthetics.
And Darren Korb.
Yeah. I had a lot of fun playing Transistor. I didn't actually finish the game, but I was drawn to that one a lot. I've tried playing Pyre a number of times. The thing that always draws me to Pyre is just like how beautiful it is. I wasn't like a huge fan of the actual like sort of game loop, I guess. And then of course, you know, Bastion's like an awesome game. So I sort of just follow their games, and whenever they release something, I'm always excited to, you know, give it a shot. So that's sort of why this was on my radar. And at the, you know, time it was announced, I was getting really into roguelikes already, so I was like, of course, you know, I want to try this one. I guess that's sort of how I discovered it and started playing it.
Yeah, and Pyre is a game that actually I love to talk about in the show because it's so weird. It's such a weird game. And weird isn't bad, but it's the range of reactions to it have gone from, I have never heard of this game, to, you know, I wish more people played it. And your reaction is right in the middle there. And I think that Supergiant has some goodwill just because they have such a tenured team of really talented people and their aesthetics are always on point. Really just look and feel, sight and sound is always amazing. But then Hades was a very different kind of phenomenon. Did you pick it up right when the 1.0 release came out?
Was the 1.0 release like
September-ish?
Okay, no, I picked it up well before that.
So you were actually in early access, yeah.
Yeah, I did join in early access. I think like when I first started playing, maybe they only had like the Hydra, or maybe...
Oh, so way back, way, way back. They hadn't added Elysium yet.
Right, and so then I actually stopped playing it for like quite a long time. And then when 1.0 came out, I went back and started playing it again. So I think I probably had like 40, 50 hours in it before then, before 1.0.
And... Well, here we are. It's what was your first reaction to the finished product, and how has your relationship with the game grown? Are you pushing heat? Are you just trying stuff out? You know, you've put in a couple hundred hours into the game, so.
Yeah. My relationship with the game is really positive. I mean, I haven't been playing as much as I have in the past couple months, but I think one of the biggest things that I enjoyed about the game once they sort of brought it into 1.0 is that they sort of made it easier to understand like how to do the sort of cool things. When I first started playing the game, I had a really hard time understanding what I was supposed to be doing, like without going to the wiki page to sort of make a cool build. I just felt like I was like acquiring stuff. There's obviously some like not so hidden logic as to how the boons will appear. And so I didn't really understand how to manipulate that stuff. I didn't understand how you got duos. I just thought they appeared sometimes. I thought maybe I had a higher chance to get duos when, you know, there was those sort of like double boon rooms. But, you know, then once they put in the journal, it was like, oh, there's just prerequisites for this. And that's like what really sent the game into like the next level of excitement for me. Cause then I was like, oh, well, I want to try all these builds, right? Cause I can sort of envision them. And beforehand, I was just going through the rooms and I'm like, well, I didn't get anything good this run. So that is something that sent me like really back into just I want to play this a lot and try all these different things. I have a lot of fun like playing with all the weapons and just trying out different ones. I haven't been like hard pushing heat. I mean, I think I've sort of just been moving like one by one through the heat with all the weapons. So I think maybe the highest I've done is probably like, you know, 16, 17 or something. But I don't usually have too hard of a time at that heat either. So I'm sure like if I was just like playing one weapon and just going, I might be able to make it pretty far.
Yeah, there's a breadth of experience there, and duos are kind of builds in and of themselves. Having that kind of player experience where you can know what you're looking for is so important. To bring it back to Battlegrounds, you don't reroll if you don't know what you're looking for. You just buy what's on the board. And so, they have literal rerolls in Hades if you level up the mirror enough, but just knowing what you're going for and knowing what to take, I can't imagine what the game was like without the codex requirements being in the journal. But before 1.0, that was just how it was for years. So I'm really glad they put that in. You know, it's a complicated genre, and roguelikes are historically pretty punishing. Hades manages to work around the feeling of that, even though the gameplay loop is still, when you die, you die. Right. But there's, well, we're going to get into the design of it in a second. Before we do, though, game questions. Lightning round. Favorite aspect, if you had to pick one.
It's definitely the gun. The gun is my favorite weapon.
So, are you an Eris player? Are you a Hestia player?
I'm the, I want to say it's Hestia. It's the one where it's, okay, it's the one after you reload, you get a stronger shot.
Yeah, Hestia.
Yeah, that's my favorite one for sure. I don't think it's the best one, but it's my favorite one. I like to do a little build with it where, I switch, like, all my mirror, traits, I guess, to, like, it's like, if you shoot someone that's not damaged, it does extra damage, and one where you're at, like, higher health, you do more damage.
You run
and
high confidence? Ooh.
Yeah. Rave. And so I run all that stuff, and all, I just, like, try to get Artemis boons, like, right away, and so that I can just have crits, basically.
You want big numbers. So, you're in search of big numbers.
I'm going for like one shots. So I just like, I shoot a shot, I reload, shoot a shot, reload, like over and over again. And I just have to like never get hit. And you sort of just like one shot everything. So I try to get that. I try to get the Artemis attack plus the Ares boon that makes it so whenever you kill something, your next attack deals like 200% increased damage. And so I basically just go on that cycle of like reload, shoot a guy, reload, shoot a guy, and you know, one shot everything. It's really fun. It falls off pretty hard, you know, towards the end of the run. It's actually better against Hades than most of the other bosses because you have the little skulls to shoot to sort of get the extra damage, but it definitely
struggles. Against heroes. Like, heroes, sure. I think. That's, probably pretty good in stick tunnels. Probably pretty good there. And you can set up for hunting blades to help out. Like, it sounds kind of nice. Favorite character?
I'm a pretty big fan of Medusa, I think.
Medusa? She's so great.
Yeah, I like Medusa's little, like, just story arc. I think it's funny, and it's cute, and it sort of comes, like, after the fact, you know? It sort of keeps you involved in what's going on in the house.
It's such a... The midpoint of that arc is so compelling. Like, wait, when does she come back? What's going on?
Yeah, it was also, like, one of the only story arcs that really like changed my perception of like one of the other characters, where it's like, you know, I liked Meg and I liked Meg the whole time and stuff like that, but you know, suddenly I was like, no, I don't know if I like Dix that much anymore. You know, so I like that story. I thought it was funny.
Expertly written. Courtney Vinaeus, the voice of Dusa, was our guest last week. You know, she's
oh, really?
Super nice. Yes. That's super awesome. Duper nice, and a burgeoning Twitch star. So your comfort build, you kind of talked about your Hestia thing. What's the enemy you hate the most? I have a theory, given your favorite build.
It's gotta be... So my favorite build doesn't actually have a problem with the butterfly balls, but, you know, I feel like I encounter a number of runs that struggle with that one room with the super butterfly ball that's, like, teleporting all over the place. So that one is definitely one that stands out in my mind. It's like, oh god, this is like a really annoying enemy to fight for me.
You just randomly take damage sometimes. I assume that you hate shieldmen. I assume the great shields are a pain in the butt for you.
Shieldmen are definitely annoying. But at the same time, you know, with that build specifically, like, since you sort of have to be pretty conscious about where you're shooting all the time, it's like, you dash behind them once and you just end them instantly with a shot. So you get them out of the way pretty fast, but you do have to like consciously be aware of like, okay, what's going on. I think the big chariots are another one that are not my favorite because you have to think pretty far in advance about like your sort of path. And it never really struck me as super intuitive that casts would sort of like stop them. And maybe that's just because like casts can look so different. Like it seems weird that like my gun doesn't stop the chariot when it's running at me, but this little like red gem does. So that's always something that like takes me time to get used to, like even just from run to run, I forget sometimes.
Yeah, the mechanics are interesting. I think I don't know this. I'm sure it's in the wiki, but I think there's a damage threshold where when the chariot takes a certain amount of damage, it stops. But I do know that the gun specifically has no knockback by design, right. And the cast don't have that restriction. It's not something that's, it's not like it's present on one, not the other. It's specifically removed from the gun, which is kind of an interesting differentiation. So our topic for this week, we were chatting a bit about this beforehand. I mean, you describe yourself as a design nerd who plays games and not as a gamer who designs. And Hades, there have been so many people that have talked about the design of Hades, but something that we were chatting about yesterday, that Polygon released a video yesterday, or 2 days ago, a roguelike for people who hate roguelikes. And it's easy in this sphere to have the perception that roguelikes are everywhere and they're super popular, but it's not like there are all that many mainstream successful titles. If you talk to a bunch of strategy card gamers who spend a ton of time, you know, playing Hearthstone or Slay the Spire or whatever, then you're going to get a different perception than if you look at the bestseller list. So the interesting thing about Hades is its popularity. And I'm wondering where you think that comes from, and our conversation will kind of spin from there based on whatever brilliant ideas you have.
Sure. Yeah, so I mean, just like you said, you know, the roguelike genre, it, you know, especially before Hades, is, it doesn't have a ton of visibility in sort of like, you know, I guess mainstream gaming. I mean, to like maybe a lot of the super engaged PC gamers who like strategy games and sort of like, I guess like dungeon crawlers, right? That they're much more popular amongst that audience. But I think it's easy for us to forget about like how many quote unquote gamers there are out there and what kinds of games they're playing. Like there's a huge audience of people who play sports games, right? And they play them for very similar reasons that we enjoy, you know, a roguelike, but they just don't have exposure to a roguelike. Or, you know, my mom plays Words with Friends every day. You know, shoot, does that make her a gamer? I mean, I think it does make her a gamer, but you know, she'd never hear about a roguelike. She wouldn't even know what a roguelike is if I, you know, mentioned it to her. So
yeah. The genre title is literally saying it's like this other game that came out 30 years ago.
Right, exactly.
Or, I'm sorry, 40 years ago.
Yeah. So I think it's, I think Hades does a really good job of sort of modernizing the genre in a lot of ways, even though, you know, at its core, it's really the same type of experience. It sort of attracts different audiences of people through multiple different means, you know. And the most obvious one is just the art and the story, right? It's a huge draw for why people play Hades. I mean, I know tons of people who play Hades and have enjoyed playing Hades who they didn't know anything about builds. They didn't think about builds. They never thought about the strategy of it. They just wanted to know what was going to happen next. And they were just playing it, you know, sort of like a story adventure game. Not thinking about the system so much, not thinking about how to optimize, you know, combat. And they just play the weapon they like every time and they just go and they have a great time. And as those players play more and more and more, they start to sort of get introduced to the systems and they start to pick up some of the things. I think that is a place where like, I wish Hades did like a slightly better job is teaching people how to do the cool stuff. You know, right now it sort of is very embedded in like a bunch of menus and I think that's never like my ideal experience is trying to like open menus all the time to figure out what I'm supposed to be doing. I mean, even that is more modern than most roguelikes, right? Most roguelikes, you have a wiki page open on your other screen, like, the whole time trying to figure out how to do anything. So, I think it's really done a great job at just making it accessible, you know, make it super accessible, and it sort of disguises the systems in a really elegant way.
Yeah, it's... we talked about this with Jay, who's on the WoW team, a system designer for the WoW team, a few episodes ago. It doesn't give you a call until, I think, run number 10. Mm-hmm. And then when it does, Poseidon shows up. It's the first time first or second time you've seen Poseidon. And then he gives you his call, and that's the only option. And then you get to learn how to use it. And that kind of guided introduction that you almost don't know is happening is really cool. They don't do that for duos. And it would be, like, I love how they have the two different gods pop up, and some of the duos are just, you know, have two level one boons at the same gods. It's going to happen organically. But there's no kind of guidance there as to how you're going to get there. So I'm glad that it's in the boon list, but a lot of players don't even know the boon list exists. It's, right. You know, it's a 1.0 edition. It's a contractor upgrade. I love that players don't need that. I love that you can clear on Zero Heat without a single duo, and you can just, like, palm an attack and you're fine, because there is a really major player mastery element. But also, if you think about Hades, it's a very system-heavy game, and it's kind of surprising how accessible it is with so much going on.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that is a huge challenge. Like, I'm sure that they dealt with, you know, and talked about many times during development. It's like, they do such an amazing job of making, you know, games that are really magnificent pieces of art.
Yeah.
And it's like my favorite thing about playing their games is that, like, you know, I really notice the attention to detail and how that's at the forefront of their mind, you know? And I think it's hard, right? It's got to be really hard to balance the artistic elements where, like, they don't want to break your immersion and, you know, force you to be looking through menus all the time when they really just want you to play through the story. So, you know, there are negatives to making all that stuff super player facing as well, right? Where, like, they could give you a tutorial that is just really cut and dry, like, do this thing, this is how you do this thing. But then, you know, maybe that would scare away a certain audience of people. Whereas, like, if you're sort of learning through almost the story, right, it's you're learning about the systems through playing through the story. It's sort of like it's disguising it, right? It's disguising what they're trying to do for you.
And it's very elegant because you're not learning, you're watching Zagreus learn. And that kind of character projection and immersion is so powerful. He seems like he starts off being a punk kid that just wants to, like, fight his way out of dad's house. And dad's like, all right, do what you want. You're not going to get very far. And you don't get very far, right? For the characters and the experience right. to be so congruent is really, really special. And the first time you get to Meg, you're like, who's this lady? And then she kicks your ass every single time.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, she's going to be tough. And getting back there and conquering her, if there was, like, a press X to duck equivalent in Hades, it would remove so much of that immersion. Because it's right. it's so overt. There are a couple buttons here and there, like while you're talking to Skelly, you know, on the top left of the screen, stuff pops up. But otherwise, the characters are telling you what's going to happen, and you get to experience it as Zagreus as opposed to as a player controlling Zagreus. And it's a very, very different vibe. I mean, they're creative, like you said. It's very dialed in.
Right, yeah. I mean, just the you getting better, it plays right into the story, right? It's very different from playing, you know, the typical roguelike where, you know, if you're playing like Slay the Spire or Rogue Legacy, like you're getting better as you're going. There's a little bit of meta progression right in those games, but you're just getting better. You just feel yourself getting better and you just get further in the runs, right? But in Hades, as you're getting better, as you're getting further in the run, that is the story arc, right? It's like you're getting stronger and you're getting both stronger through meta progression and through just actual learning and playing the game naturally. So, and then they have tons of story beats to reflect that, right? Which is really awesome, honestly.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, we've gushed about the combination, the fusion of story and the removal of, I was talking to a friend about a different roguelike that I've been playing lately. And his concern is that most roguelikes, your runs always end in a fail state. That happens quite often, especially with endless games. And so a lot of the more modern ones, you know, they have a clear beginning, middle, and end. But a lot of times it's, you know, I play until I die. And Hades has much more of a closed loop, even though that first time through it feels like, you know, I wonder how long this game can go on.
Right. Yeah, that is, like, I mean, that whole concept is just really a very complicated topic, I think, for roguelikes in general, is that for the most part, like, I guess if you were to really abstract, like, they're sort of designed for you to lose.
Yeah.
Which is, like, how do you make a fun game that's, it's supposed to be against the player, right? It's, like, usually players want to win, they want to feel good about winning in single-player games, but in this case, we're designing a game that, like, you're going to lose. And to sort of bring, like, to hide that, first of all, right, is really difficult. And to sort of mask it as, like, oh, well, losing is actually really fun in this game because you're always anticipating, you know, something new, right? It's not just that you're anticipating the next run. You're also anticipating, like, how the story is progressing. And the story is often very closely tied to what happened in your run. So, especially, you know, when you're playing through the beginning of the game. And so it really does a great job there of, I think, acknowledging the fact that they sort of are making a game that you're intended to lose a lot in, and they're trying to make you lose for a pretty long period of time, you know, and to not just make that feel horrible.
And to make you want to do it again, Hades has the biggest just one more run energy I can think of, because the loop is when you finish a Slay the Spire run, you go back to the title screen. Okay, I'm gonna press the quit button. When you die in Hades, you wind up back at the house. Okay, just gotta talk to all the characters. Okay, just gonna see what's in the shop. Okay, just gonna see what I can unlock in my mirror. Okay, just gonna see what weapon is gone. Okay, just gonna see what the first room is like. Oh, the sun's coming up. What's going on? And it's each element pushes you a little bit towards the next one. And to harken back a little bit as well, you'd said something earlier that you wanted to be a balanced designer. And I've thought about PvE versus PvP balance, single player versus multiplayer. But also, this is something that Dean was talking about, Ixar, the lead designer mm-hmm. of Hearthstone, is that some of the most fun memories in games are when you get to do the broken thing, when you get to do the thing that feels like you're cheating and pushing the boundaries. So that's something that I think in your game, in Battlegrounds, sometimes you get Macaw Beasts or Pirate Exodia or whatever, and you feel like, wow, all these crazy pieces came together, I'm going to make a YouTube video out of this. Sometimes in Hades, you get that, you know, Merciful End Fist, and you're like, everything just falls apart. How do you make that possible, make it rare enough, and then make it compelling for the player, and also not so powerful that you don't want to repeat the same experience over and over?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a bunch of different ways to approach those sort of problems and topics. It's like, you know, balance design is far from a science.
Yeah.
As much as there are, like, numbers associated with balancing things in PvP games especially, you know, it comes down to the sort of perceived effects of those numbers, right? Like, I'm sure there's been many times in many games where, you know, the actual mathematical best thing it's not actually the best thing in the community. And maybe it's because people haven't discovered it, or maybe it's just because it doesn't feel super bad to play against or whatnot. It's like a constant balance of, you know, pun sort of intended, of, like, you know, like, you want to create really fun moments with things, but the players have to feel it, right? Like, they have to really feel the effects of your changes. And I think between PvE and PvP games, there's a sort of an important distinction when you're approaching balance, is that, like, first of all, in a PvE game, you generally have a bit more leeway, right? Because there's not another player on the other side. So as long as your balance changes aren't really warping the game to sort of have a negative loop, you know, in the single player context, where, like, you know, I think in this case, the negative loop could be something like, you could get the same build every single game and it is the best build, right? And that would take away from the roguelike experience a lot. But, you know, in general, you can make things that are just really just insanely powerful in PvE games, and it can be okay. And you can sort of tweak the rarity there, so to speak, to make it fair, I guess you could say.
Yeah. It's kind of what they've done with Athena's dash. They removed her dash as a prerequisite from a few builds just because people naturally wanted to start with dash anyways and would just end up deadly reversal, merciful end, everything dies, whatever. So you just make that kind of harder to get to.
Right. And then, you know, in a PvP game, you want to create those really awesome story moments. You know, it's part of why people play PvP games, is there's just an inherent storyline built into it, is that I beat someone else, right? That's always there. And that's a really exciting feeling to a lot of people. So But at the same time, that person is like almost sort of like a victim of the story, right? So sometimes stories can feel so negative to that victim where, you know, it can really drive them away from something. There's no science to it really, but, you know, that person's negative story is just sort of necessary to making really good experiences as well. Like, if you don't have some negative experiences, then the good experiences feel a lot worse. Worse meaning they just don't feel as good because there's no context. So finding that balance is really difficult, and it can change from day to day, because maybe the bad story didn't feel so bad the first five times it happens to you, but maybe by the 100th time it's feeling really bad. I guess that's like really the big challenge of PvP balance in general.
Yeah, and they've been able to get, Hades obviously doesn't have that kind of problem, though they also had multiple years of early access and that kind of testing and honing. I don't know. Sometimes I wish that the PvP games we play had that sort of PTR equivalent where you can tune and test and tweak, but also it's just a very different experience overall. Something that I've been thinking about as well, you look at the keepsakes in Hades. Mm-hmm. The keepsakes are, I think a lot of newer players maybe just like they take tooth and they roll with it or whatever. But it allows a lot of control. It allows the player to kind of curate their experience. Do you think it creates too much sameness, or do you think it allows players to drive the bus but not, choose the destination too much? Where do you land on that?
Yeah, that is definitely something I think about in Hades a lot. I mean, I think Hades is amazing. Like, I love playing it still, but I would definitely not argue that, Hades is like a 1,000-hour game. You know, there's a much more finite number of outcomes, I think, than a lot of other roguelikes. And it's because of things like the keepsakes. And so it's hard to evaluate like what is correct per se, because, it sort of depends what the goals are of the game. Like, if they wanted to make a 100-hour game, for example, like that was their ultimate goal. Like, we wanted to make a game that people just love playing for an hour or for 100 hours. It's this beautiful piece of art. Like, I mean, they amazingly succeeded in that regard, right? If they wanted to make a game that I could do runs forever, then I would probably start to argue that keepsakes might build against that at some point. When I first even learned about like how to use keepsakes in a run, which I didn't know how to use them correctly for the, when I played it in early access.
I'm gonna take a stand against correctly. I'm gonna say optimally. I think it's slightly different.
Sure,
I don't want to tell players you're using these the wrong way, just in terms of like strategic optimization.
Right. Yeah, I started to really get more powerful first of all in my runs, and that created a lot of excitement for me initially. But maybe 15 hours later, I was finding myself doing very similar patterns with my keepsakes and my runs from there on. So the positive there is, I sort of leveled myself up. I got some new stories out of it. But the negative was that my story started getting really similar. The sort of variation was coming just strictly through like the different types of builds, but the path to getting to those builds was very similar each game. And I wouldn't argue that that's a negative either. It's really hard for me to know or evaluate it as like a positive or a negative. It's sort of just like, this is a thing that happens to a lot of the players, right?
It's a design choice.
It's definitely one of the most interesting topics in Hades is like, is that right? Like, I mean, maybe it's good because for a larger audience of players, it's more approachable. And those players, they might need that to sort of experience the upper end of the stories. It just sort of is a bit more of a guiding hand, and it takes away a lot of the throwaway runs, where you're fishing for that dream, right? This helps you get to that dream much faster in a shorter, number of runs usually.
Yeah, it raises the floor. It reduces the grind for sure, And there is some value in that being an option. They're also, they're technically opt-in, but typically competitive players don't go for the less powerful option most of the time, unless they're actively searching variety. But there is the brilliant endgame system in the Pact of Punishment. And I don't know, I just want to hear you talk about this because I love what they did with it. I think it's a really, really great system.
Yeah, so, I mean, in general, like, I am someone who personally dislikes opt-in difficulty. And that's not to say that it's bad or isn't fun or that people don't enjoy it. Me, personally, I don't enjoy it because, like, I kind of just want the game to get harder for me without, you know, sort of setting myself up for failure. That's what it feels like to me emotionally. It's like, I look at this thing and I'm like, I don't want to play against that. And I look at another thing, I'm like, I don't want to play against that either.
So this is the TV versus Netflix dilemma. This is the turn it on and let it happen, or I have to choose.
Right. So yes, I do want a system to make the game harder and have more, you know, sort of, I guess, stuff to experience, right? One of the ones that I do really enjoy is opting into the harder bosses for the most part. It's just because I know it's like a pretty severe, like different mechanical thing going on, and it sort of unlocks more story beats. So that part felt pretty awesome to me, but like some of the other stuff, you know, I don't personally want to opt into having to, you know, shoot everything one extra time, or, you know, it's hard to convince myself to opt into taking tons of more damage from traps and stuff like that. I don't have a problem with taking more damage from traps, but it's just the action, right? The action of having to do it myself is something that I don't find particularly enjoyable. And it's one of the ways, like, if I were to make a roguelike today that was very Hades inspired, like, that would be a place of that I would try to explore, like iterating on. And maybe I would not succeed. Like maybe they spent tons of time trying to figure out something else and this is what they landed on, or maybe it was just something they tried and they liked it. But it would definitely be one of the places that I personally, as someone who enjoys roguelikes, would want to try to find a more elegant iteration of. I haven't really enjoyed that system in any roguelikes I've played or games. In general, maybe like outside of World of Warcraft, I would say, I kind Mythic of enjoy Plus. Like, cause like, yeah, I enjoy the Mythic Plus stuff, you know, historically speaking a lot, because then there was rewards that came out of it, really big rewards. So I found some joy in that. I guess I don't feel that in Hades as much, you know, or in any other roguelike as much.
Yeah, you're not into like 820 runs in Slay the Spire, for example.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that it's obviously a really cool system in a lot of ways as well, though. I mean, people love talking about what heat they're on, right? And it's sort of like a flex point almost. It's like you feel accomplished because there's a sort of easy to quantify number of like how good you are at the game, right? That's really cool. I think the opt-in difficulty thing also builds into Hades a little bit better than in other roguelikes, because they just drill into you that losing is okay. And so losing doesn't feel as bad in Hades to me as it does in other roguelikes. And that obviously helps opt-in difficulty as like a system, because you're just not going to feel as bad about opting into difficulty at that point. Yeah, I guess that would sort of be my general stance on it. I know most people that play a lot of Hades do enjoy it, but I'd be very curious to hear from the people who stopped before they reached heat. Like, you know, what does that mean for those players?
Yeah, you definitely have the holistic view from the designer, and as well as mitigating the or preventing the need for players to make choices about how they get hurt. That's kind of, I can tell that something that's in your mind of not having to give things up is kind of important. There's kind of a two sides of the iceberg, right? Like, keepsakes help guide you towards the positive stuff, and heat guides you towards the challenging stuff. And you can sometimes, where you have a combination of gods that's really, really good for you, you can have a combination of heat packs that's really bad for you. Really, really bad for you. Sometimes you end up with, I don't know, we'll say hard labor forced overtime. That faster enemies that hit you harder is really challenging. Or when you have a combination of, you know, approval process, underworld custom, sometimes you just end up with no boons because the only one you get you have to sell, for example. But yeah, the players have to choose, like, how do I get to die? And it creates variance for people that want more of the experience with a little bit of variety. But also, you have to be looking for that.
Right. Yeah. It's totally an interesting, like, dilemma of the roguelike. It's like, how do, especially a story-based one, it's like, how do they keep you going? Like, what are you going to achieve once the story inevitably ends? Or
there's no daily climb here or whatever.
Right. There's no daily climb. And to be honest, I don't even really, like, miss that element of it. But yeah, it's definitely something that would be very interesting to spend time thinking about. It was just like, what could you even have possibly done different in that space, right? Like, to make people just want to go do the next run and sort of progress them on difficulty, like, maybe even without really just telling them in a super explicit way. Like, you know, if Hades is, you know, sitting on the throne and just saying, like, you know, a bunch of story beats that sort of express that things are going to be getting way harder and way harder and way harder. You know, how do you then translate that into gameplay without, you know, things, numbers showing to tell you explicitly what's going to be happening?
It's an interesting thought experiment. Well, I have one more question for you, and it's a doozy, and I'm sure you've thought about this many, many times. Think about some of the mechanics we talked about. The mechanic that you just talked about would introduce a lot of randomness. And there's already a degree of that in Hades, right? And I think one of the best examples of how it can be player-friendly is the Dark Thirst, the purple glow, mm-hmm. that when it glows, you're compelled to take that weapon, but you don't have to. But it's kind of nice that if you want to give into the game, you get more variety. But you're not forced to. Whereas sometimes there's some randomness. I didn't see this boon. I didn't get this duo. You know, I rolled Asterius instead of Butterfly Ball or whatever. Or, in particular, the sack mechanic. You will see the fountain between 2 and 5 hallways and sticks, and it's completely random after the first hallway. You know it's not the first one, you don't know about the next one. What is the role that randomness plays in adding a positive gameplay experience in this game, and maybe even in general?
Well, randomness is, I mean, the topic of randomness is very complicated, especially in games, right? And it's something you can talk about for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. I mean, randomness is really at the core of what the roguelike experience is. I mean, there's pretty much randomness in almost all really successful games to some extent. It's not pure, like, you know, entropy type randomness in games like StarCraft, for example, right? But there's like some unknown information that's always going on, and it feels pseudo random. So I think in Hades and roguelikes in general, the randomness is sort of why the games are fun. You have to, if it was super predictable, right? Like you wouldn't want to play through the runs again and again and again, especially past the story, right? Because the adventure that you go through and the progression you go through in each run is what creates the really interesting player stories. And Hades sort of has like this curved random feel to it where it's more in your favor in general than it is against you. But the ones that feel sort of against you really do help amplify the good randomness stories. And they do a pretty good job of making the not, you know, so great stories not feel super bad through some of the things we've already talked about, but even just through the actual, you know, mechanics of how a run works and how you can control your character. So I think one of the important aspects of randomness existing in games in general, and especially a game like this, is also like, well, what is the consistent aspects that sort of, I guess, complement the randomness? And so one of the things is that Hades has this really amazing control system. Your character feels incredible to control, you know, better than most games I've ever played, I would say. It's almost fighting game-esque in terms of like how precise and responsive and pretty intuitive for the most part of like how your character can be controlled. And that's sort of like it's like a physical element of the game that's very consistent. It's almost like, you know, if you're playing a sport or something, you're practicing building the sort of muscle memory of something. And that is a skill that you're building that is consistent as you're going and playing through the randomness of each run. You will consistently get better and better and better. And there's not going to be a point where you suddenly get worse at dashing most of the time, right? Or worse at using the sword. If you've been doing like only runs with the sword, right? You're just going to get better at that. And that's like an important consistency aspect that you pick at the very start of the run that really complements the randomness. And it makes the randomness feel slightly less bad in the bad cases and way better in the really good cases, because you've been building on this thing and you've been waiting for you to sort of random into that really powerful thing, and you've got all these skills you've acquired through the consistency of increasing your ability to control your character, right? So I guess long story short, like, you know, the randomness in Hades is really what creates so much of the experience. And they did a really great job of, you know, sort of, I guess, masking the system of randomness and putting it in sort of a new light that's really simple that you interact with. I mean, I feel like I could talk forever about it, but just the simple concept of like, you go into a room, you know, every single time you're going to get a reward after the room and you're excited about that. And then once you finish the room, there's this really like seemingly simple choice, right? There's like usually just two options. And the randomness at that point is, first of all, like, you don't know exactly what the two options are, but you do know the consistency part is that it's going to be something, and usually it's going to be something that makes you more powerful. And then the next level of randomness is like, okay, well, like, you know, if you're choosing between Ares or like Athena or something, you're like, well, I don't know exactly what the boon is going to be if I pick Athena, but I have a good idea. And you get to make a really cool, sort of puzzly, educated decision based on what you know about the randomness, because they make it approachable.
Yeah, and right, we could talk about this forever. And something that Amira said in another show when it comes to balance is that one of the things he feels most proud of is that players can have played this game for 1,000 hours and a boon selection screen comes up and they have to pause and think about it. That the idea is there, it's not a closed loop and a solved system, that it's going to be different every time based on what you've done so far. The sack mechanic is kind of what I wanted to dial in, because it's just like, it is Hades' equivalent of hyphen RNG. It is the Hades crackle, right? For Hearthstone players out there. But when you talked about storylines, I think about, I cleared a run in 1940 on tight deadline 3 with Arthur on a 5-sack. And I was like, I had 4 seconds left before I started taking damage, and I got it on the last thing, but I still cleared the run. Or there are other runs where I was close, but I lost because it was a 4-sack or a 5-sack, and it was right on the border. It gives you something to talk about, and maybe there's an element where if you're a speedrunner or a high-heat competitor and you've played for 1,000 hours, that might be something that stands out to you. But look at any game where a competitive community springs up, but the game is not inherently competitive, and there are going to be some sharp edges there, because it's at odds with the game's core purpose, and still, it provides variety and conversation, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, the sack randomness is kind of interesting, too, because I'm not, like, I wouldn't claim to be someone who has, you know, hyper-optimized or thought about, you know, how to do a speed run, per se, of Hades. You know, I would consider myself a reasonably good player who's done a lot of runs, but, you know, I do think about this, the sack, and, like, when it's going to happen, and there's some element of consistency to that randomness, right, where it's, like, there's not an infinite number of rooms that the sack could appear in. There's, like, 5 or 6, right? And so there is some mastery there, which is important, right? And I think there is, you know, there's some potential for a cool story to come out of it, where, like, there are different scenarios where, like, you might want a sack, like, super early, and that is ideal because, you know, you just want to do the run as fast as possible. But then there's also scenarios where, like, you know, maybe you're just a player who wants to go through and complete everything, and you getting the sack in the last room means that you get to basically heal the full life, you know, pseudo-efficiently before you fight the last boss. And that is a different, you know, good story for a different type of player. I think within that, there is some, you know, sort of system-y ways of optimizing in accordance with, like, the sacks, right? Like, because you can sort of get the Well of Charon buffs, and they can overlap going into the last boss if you get lucky timing the sack. And I think, you know, maybe for the sake of building a sort of a speed run, right, that's going to create many more repetitions for you to sort of get the dream run. But for the general consumer, and maybe even the more, you know, serious consumer, there's like a really cool, you know, story moment that can come out of that, which is, oh, I got all these Well of Charon buffs, and then I got the sack. And I was like, wow, I got to carry all of these into the last boss. I mean, I've definitely sent screenshots of that to my friends where I've had like a bunch of Well of Charon buffs, and I'm like, wow, like this never happens, you know? And that's kind of a cool experience that comes out of that randomness. For sure, it's like it's an impossible, I guess, problem to solve if you're trying to, like, you know, if they hypothetically were trying to create a really awesome experience for, you know, the most hardcore speedrunner, and then they're also just trying to create variation from, you know, run to run for people. Randomness is always going to impact speedrunners, right? And that's one of the more explicit ones in the game that sort of just increases your runtime, right? So, yeah, I mean, maybe it doesn't complement the timed runs that well. Like, maybe that system is bad in that regard.
But there's a large topic to be had here that we don't have time for, of designing a game for the majority versus designing a game for the outliers, and that's a conversation for another day, my friend.
For sure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks so much for coming on. Where can we find you if you want to chat, and any shout-outs that you have?
Well, I mean, I'm on Twitter, just, you know, at ConnorQ. I'm not the most active Twitter person, but I definitely see people when they message me, so that's where you can find me.
Yes, well, thank you so much, and, you know, we'll tweet at you whenever we need, what it's supposed to say, invisible fairies to fix things. Yes. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on. Really great to hear your insight into a game that you don't work on. You know, we'll see you on the battlegrounds. And listeners, please follow the show at Hidden Aspects on Twitter. Subscribe in your podcast client. Thank you so much for tuning in this larger look at game design this week. We talked about Hades here and there, but I just like thinking about how games work. But until next week, we'll see you in hell.